A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's the thing about concrete. Everyone treats it like it's this permanent, unchanging thing. You pour it, it hardens, it sits there forever. But that's completely wrong. Every building is slowly trying to destroy itself. Concrete is under constant stress from gravity, the ground shifting beneath it. Temperature swings, moisture. It's a material in a lifelong wrestling match with physics. And it loses in slow motion.
The wild part is, most people have seen the evidence of this fight with their own eyes and just didn't have the vocabulary for what they were looking at. The hairline crack running diagonally from the corner of a doorframe. The window that used to open smoothly and now sticks. The floor where a marble rolls on its own. These aren't random quirks, they're concrete speaking a language, and almost nobody knows how to read it.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about those episodes we did on blast-resistant concrete and what bedrock actually means in construction, and he's zeroing in on something much more everyday. The failure modes that show up in ordinary buildings over time. The cracks, the deformations, the stuff you can see with the naked eye. And he's asking us to walk through the physics of why these things happen, what the different categories mean, and why prevention is basically the only economically sane strategy. Because fixing foundation problems after the fact costs multiples of what it would have cost to do it right in the first place.
That economic asymmetry is brutal, and we'll get to numbers that'll make any homeowner wince. But first I want to sit with that tension you opened with. Concrete is permanent versus concrete is constantly deforming. Because it shapes whether someone sees a crack and thinks, oh, the building's falling down, or sees the same crack and thinks, that's normal shrinkage, I'll keep an eye on it. The difference between those two reactions is knowing what's actually happening inside the material.
The thing that makes concrete so weird as a material, and so prone to visible cracking, is that it's a total mismatch between what it's good at and what it's bad at. Concrete is fantastic in compression. You can stack enormous weight on it and it just sits there, happy as anything, but in tension? Pull it apart and it fails at roughly 10% of its compressive strength. That asymmetry drives almost everything we're going to talk about.
Standard structural concrete, 20 to 40 megapascals in compression. You could park a loaded freight truck on a column the size of a dinner plate and it would hold. But that same concrete in tension? 2 to 5 megapascals. It's basically chalk. And in a real building, almost every structural element experiences some tension somewhere. A beam bending under floor load has tension along its bottom face. A wall with earth pushing against it has tension on the inside face. The material is constantly being asked to do the thing it's worst at.
Concrete's like a friend who's great at carrying heavy boxes but absolutely cannot be asked to stretch. You load him up, fine. You ask him to reach for something, he snaps.
That's a perfect image. And the engineering solution is steel reinforcement. Rebar handles the tension, concrete handles the compression. They're the buddy cop duo of construction. But that partnership isn't perfect either. The bond between steel and concrete can fail, moisture can reach the rebar and corrode it, and when that happens, you get a whole new category of visible problems.
Let's lay out what we're actually tracing. The visible failure pattern in concrete buildings fall into two big buckets. One is internal stress failures, tension, compression, shear, torsion, bending. The material itself breaking under the loads it's carrying. The other bucket is external and environmental, foundation settlement, thermal expansion and contraction, shrinkage during curing, chemical attack. The reason this distinction matters is that the cracks look different depending on which bucket they come from, and knowing how to read those differences is what separates. Call an engineer from patch it and paint over it.
We should be clear up front. Most cracks in most buildings are not emergencies. It's what the material does. The question is, which cracks are telling you a story you need to act on, and which ones are just concrete being concrete? The difference often comes down to width, pattern, location, and whether the crack is changing over time.
The crack that's been the same hairline for 5 years is a completely different animal from the one that was a hairline last month and is now wide enough to fit a coin. One is a scar, the other is a wound that's still bleeding.
That's what makes this practical. People live in buildings, they see these things, they wonder whether to worry. Giving them a framework for that decision, that's what Daniel's really asking for.
Let's start with the physics. If we're going to understand what concrete does when it fails, we need to understand what it's doing when it's just sitting there, apparently doing nothing at all.
When concrete is just sitting there holding up a building, it's in a state of constant microdeformation. Every floor slab has tension along its bottom face from the weight above. Every column is being compressed. Every beam is bending. Top in compression, bottom in tension. It's all happening at scales too small to see, but the forces are real and they never stop.
This is where the asymmetry becomes the whole story. When a beam bends under load, the top half, in compression, is barely breaking a sweat. But the bottom half is being asked to do the one thing it's terrible at, and that's where cracks start.
The numbers are worth sitting with. Standard structural concrete, 20 to 40 megapascals in compression. A column the size of your palm could theoretically hold up a fully loaded SUV. But in tension, that same concrete fails at 2 to 5 megapascals. You could probably pull a cylinder of it apart by hand if you had a good enough grip. That's the fundamental design problem that rebar exists to solve.
The internal stress failures are basically the different ways you can ask concrete to do the thing it's bad at. Tension pulls it apart, shear slides layers past each other, torsion twists it, and bending combines tension and compression in a single element. Each leaves a different signature in the visible cracking pattern.
That's the framework. Internal stress failures tell you what direction the forces were acting when the material gave up. And then you've got the external bucket, settlement, thermal movement, shrinkage, chemical attack, where the forces come from outside the structural element itself. Those produce different crack patterns entirely.
The reason a non-engineer should care about the difference between a shear crack and a settlement crack is that they imply completely different problems with completely different price tags. A shear crack near a beam support says this structural element is overloaded. A diagonal settlement crack above a doorframe says the ground under one corner of your foundation is moving. One might need a structural retrofit, the other might need helical piers driven down to bedrock. Very different contractors, very different checks to write.
That's before we even get to the economic asymmetry Daniel was hinting at. Foundation settlement repairs routinely cost 2 to 5 times what the original foundation cost to pour. You're not just paying for the fix, you're paying to access the problem. Excavation, shoring, sometimes temporarily relocating the building's occupants. The Houston case from a few years back is the poster child. A house on expansive clay experienced 150 millimeters of differential settlement over 5 years. Repair cost was $85,000 for 14 helical piers. The original foundation cost $18,000. That's nearly a 5-to-1 ratio.
The math on prevention versus remediation isn't subtle. It's the difference between spending a few thousand extra on soil borings and proper compaction before you pour, versus spending a new car's worth of money to jack your house back into position after the fact. And the really galling part is that the warning signs were probably visible years before anyone acted on them.
Sticking doors, windows that won't latch, floors that slope just enough that you notice it when you're carrying a cup of coffee. These are the early signals of differential settlement, and people dismiss them as normal aging for years. Meanwhile, the underlying problem is getting worse, and the repair cost is climbing.
Before we dig into the specific failure pattern, the takeaway is this. Concrete is a material that's spectacular at one thing and terrible at another, and almost every visible crack is a record of the moment it was asked to do the thing it's terrible at. The question is whether that moment was a one-time event during curing, or part of an ongoing process that's still active.
The way you answer that question is by learning to read the cracks themselves, their shape, their width, their location, and whether they're changing. Which brings us to the 4 fundamental ways concrete fails under internal stress. Let's walk through them in the order they typically show up when a concrete element is overloaded. Picture a simply supported concrete beam, a horizontal span resting on 2 supports, with load pressing down from above. As you gradually increase that load, the first thing that happens isn't compression failure at the top. It's tension failure at the bottom.
Because the bottom of the beam is being stretched as the beam bends downward. That's where the material hits its 2-5 megapascal tensile limit first, long before the top even notices it's working.
The cracks that form are textbook, vertical or near-vertical lines starting at the bottom face and propagating upward. These are flexural cracks, the most common failure pattern in concrete structures. You'll see them in the middle third of a beam span, where the bending moment is highest, and they typically stop about halfway up the beam depth, because that's where the stress transitions from tension to compression.
These are the cracks that look alarming, but are actually the least dangerous. The beam is doing exactly what it's designed to do. The steel reinforcement in the bottom takes over once the concrete cracks, and the structure remains stable.
Flexural cracking is ductile. It gives you warning. The cracks widen gradually. You can see them. You have time to react. That's why building codes are designed around this failure pattern happening first. The steel yields before the concrete crushes, and the whole thing bends visibly before it collapses. It's the failure pattern you want, if you're going to have one.
Which makes shear the one you don't want. You called it the silent killer earlier.
Shear is terrifying because it's brittle. It doesn't give you the slow, visible warning that flexural cracking does. Shear cracks form diagonally, typically at 30 to 45 degrees, near the supports of a beam or slab, and they can propagate from hairline to structural failure in a single loading event. The mechanism is something called aggregate interlock. When a shear crack forms, the two faces are rough with exposed aggregate, and that roughness initially provides some resistance as the faces slide past each other. But once that interlock fails, once the aggregate crushes or the crack widens enough, there's nothing left. The beam splits diagonally and drops.
The visible sign is a diagonal crack near where the beam meets a column or a wall. And if you see that, you don't wait.
You absolutely do not wait. And this is exactly what the forensic analysis found at Surfside in 2021. The parking garage under that condominium in Florida had visible shear cracks that had been noted in inspection reports for years. They were misdiagnosed as cosmetic, just surface cracking, nothing structural. But they were diagonal, they were near column supports, and they were telling a story that nobody was reading correctly until the building came down.
98 people died in that collapse, and the cracks had been visible.
The shear cracks in the parking deck slab were documented in a 2018 report, 3 years before the collapse. The report described them as minor and recommended sealing them. Nobody flagged them as potential shear failure indicators. It's a case study in why learning to read crack patterns matters. The difference between a flexural crack at mid-span and a diagonal shear crack near a support is the difference between monitor this and evacuate the building.
All right, so tension we can live with. Shear is the one that keeps engineers up at night. What about compression failure?
Compression failure is rare in normal service because concrete is so strong in compression, but when it happens, it's catastrophic. The concrete literally crushes. You get spalling, chunks of the surface concrete breaking off, and you'll see exposed aggregate and buckled rebar. The visible warning sign is bulging or flaking on the face of a concrete column, especially near the top or bottom where the load concentration is highest.
You mentioned over-reinforcement as a trigger for this. Which is counterintuitive. Most people think more rebar equals stronger.
That's one of the big misconceptions. If you put too much steel in a concrete element, you shift the failure pattern from ductile to brittle. In a properly designed beam, the steel yields first. You get flexural cracks, visible deflection, warning. In an over-reinforced beam, the concrete crushes in compression before the steel has a chance to yield. No warning, no visible bending, just sudden crushing. It's why structural codes enforce a balanced design principle. You want the steel to fail before the concrete, because steel failing is slow and visible.
More reinforcement is like more caffeine. There's a sweet spot, and past it, you're just asking for a different kind of problem.
Then there's the fourth internal failure pattern, bond failure between the rebar and the concrete. The two materials work as a composite because the ridges on the rebar mechanically grip the surrounding concrete. When that grip fails, either from overload, corrosion, or poor construction, you get longitudinal cracks running right along the line of the reinforcement. The visible giveaway is a crack that follows the rebar path, often with rust staining where moisture has traveled along the bar and reached the surface.
If I see a crack running horizontally along a beam, parallel to its length, with orange-brown staining around it, that's not a flexural crack. That's the rebar and concrete breaking up with each other.
It's a breakup that accelerates. Once the bond fails, the two materials stop working as a composite. The rebar can't take the tension, the concrete can't take the compression, and moisture has a direct path to the steel, which accelerates corrosion. It's a feedback loop of deterioration.
The four modes, from least to most alarming. Flexural tension cracks, which are normal and expected. Bond failure, which is a maintenance emergency. Shear, which is a structural emergency. And compression crushing, which is a get-out-of-the-building situation.
That's a good rough hierarchy. And the diagnostic key is in the geometry. Vertical cracks at mid-span say tension. Diagonal cracks near support say shear, cracks along the rebar line say bond failure, and bulging or spalling says compression. The crack pattern is a signature of the force that caused it. Those internal stress failures are one thing, but the most common visible deformations in actual buildings come from something happening below ground level. And this is where the millimeter scale precision of soil engineering becomes brutally practical.
Because the ground under a building is never perfectly uniform. One corner sits on compacted gravel, another corner sits on clay that expands when wet and shrinks when dry. The foundation is a rigid thing sitting on a surface that's constantly changing shape underneath it.
Differential settlement, where one part of the foundation sinks more than another, induces bending and shear stresses in the entire structure above. The foundation tilts, the walls distort, and the cracks that appear tell you exactly which part of the building is moving relative to which other part.
The crack geometry becomes a compass. If the center of the building is settling more than the edges, the walls get pulled outward at the top. You'll see diagonal cracks that are wider at the top than the bottom. If the edges are sinking, the walls get pulled the other way, and the cracks are wider at the bottom.
The numbers here are almost absurdly small. A differential settlement of just 5 to 10 millimeters across a 10-meter span, less than the thickness of your phone, can induce enough stress to crack masonry walls. You wouldn't notice a 5-millimeter slope in your floor by feel, but the building notices it structurally.
Which is why the marble test works. If you drop a marble on a floor and it rolls consistently in one direction, you're detecting a slope that might be too subtle to feel but is already stressing the walls.
The soil type underneath determines how big this problem can get. Foundations on competent rock typically settle less than 5 millimeters total. Foundations on clay can settle 25 to 50 millimeters. That's a 5 to 10 times difference, and it's why soil investigation before you pour isn't optional. It's the difference between a building that stays put and one that slowly tears itself apart.
When someone skips the soil borings to save $2,000, they're betting 50 years of structural stability on a blind guess about what's underground.
The Houston case is the cautionary tale. A house on expansive clay, the kind that swells when wet and shrinks when dry, experienced 150 millimeters of differential settlement over 5 years. The doors stopped closing, the windows jammed, cracks spiderwebbed through the drywall. Repair cost was $85,000 for 14 helical piers driven down to stable soil. The original foundation cost $18,000.
$85,000 to fix a problem that better drainage and a properly designed foundation could have prevented for a fraction of that. And that's before you even get to the disruption. The family had to move out for weeks while the house was literally jacked up on hydraulic supports.
The Leaning Tower of Pisa is the extreme end of this spectrum. 800 years of differential settlement on soft clay reaching a 5.5 degree tilt. The modern intervention, soil extraction from underneath the high side in the 1990s and 2000s, cost around $30 million and took 11 years. And that's a relatively simple fix compared to what you'd need for a fully collapsed tower.
Differential settlement is a slow motion disaster, but there's another category of visible cracking that's even more common and almost never dangerous, thermal and shrinkage cracking.
Concrete shrinks as it cures. The drying shrinkage is about 0.05 to 0.1% over time, which translates to roughly 0.5 millimeter to 1 millimeter of shrinkage per meter of wall length. Over a 30-meter wall, that's 15 to 30 millimeters of total shortening. If the wall is restrained, and it always is, by corners, by foundations, by intersecting walls, that shrinkage induces tension, and tension in concrete means cracks.
The evenly spaced vertical cracks you see in long concrete walls or slabs, those aren't structural failure. They're the material doing what it has to do to relieve internal stress.
Control joints are the engineered solution. You cut or form a groove in the concrete at regular intervals to create a weak plane. The crack forms there, inside the joint, where you plan for it, instead of randomly across the wall face. When control joints are missing or spaced too far apart, you get the random cracking. Hairline vertical cracks, typically less than 1 millimeter wide, spaced somewhat regularly along the wall.
Same thing with thermal expansion. A concrete slab in direct sun can expand enough to push against adjacent structures. And if there's no expansion joint to absorb the movement, something's going to crack. Usually the slab itself, or whatever it's pushing against.
This brings us to what I think is the most practically useful thing we can offer, a crack dictionary. A way to look at a crack and make an educated guess about what caused it.
All right, walk me through it.
Vertical cracks, uniform width, evenly spaced along a long wall or slab, that's shrinkage or thermal movement. Cosmetic, monitor, but don't panic. Diagonal cracks that are wider at one end than the other, that's differential settlement. The wide end points toward the part of the building that's sinking. Horizontal cracks with a stair step pattern in masonry, that's lateral pressure or shear, and it needs an engineer. Map cracking, the alligator skin pattern, that's surface shrinkage or early stage chemical attack, usually not structural but worth sealing to prevent moisture ingress.
The width rule of thumb?
Hairline cracks under 1 millimeter that haven't changed in years, almost certainly cosmetic. Cracks over 2 millimeters wide, or cracks that are actively growing, or cracks accompanied by sticking doors and sloping floors. Those warrant a professional inspection. The combination of a visible crack plus a door that suddenly won't latch is a stronger signal than either one alone. Given all these ways concrete can fail, what should someone actually do when they spot a crack in their wall? Because the spectrum runs from ignore it forever to call a structural engineer at 3 in the morning, and the difference between those two reactions is knowing a few decision rules.
The first rule is the one that probably saves people the most sleepless nights. Not all cracks are emergencies. In fact, most aren't. A hairline crack, under 1 millimeter, that's been the same width for years and isn't accompanied by anything else weird. That's concrete being concrete. Patch it if it bothers you. Paint over it. Move on with your life.
The threshold that matters is about 2 millimeters. Once a crack is wide enough to fit the edge of a coin into, or if it's actively growing. You measured it 6 months ago and now it's wider. That's when you bring in someone who knows what they're looking at. And the real red flag is the combination. A crack plus a door that suddenly sticks. A crack plus a floor that's developed a slope. A crack plus a window that won't latch. Any one of those alone might be nothing. Together, they're the building telling you something is moving that shouldn't be.
It's like a medical diagnosis, where the symptom by itself is ambiguous, but the symptom cluster is the signal. A headache alone is probably nothing. A headache plus blurred vision plus numbness. Different story entirely.
That's the clinical thinking right there. And I'd add one more diagnostic layer, location. A hairline vertical crack in the middle of a long basement wall, evenly spaced from other similar cracks? Almost certainly shrinkage. A diagonal crack radiating from the corner of a door frame on the top floor? That's the building twisting slightly from differential settlement below. Same crack width, completely different implications.
The decision framework is width, change over time, accompanying symptoms, and location. If it's thin, stable, alone, and in a predictable spot, relax. If it's wide, growing, bringing friends, or in a weird place, make the call.
The second big takeaway is that the best time to prevent all of this is before a single bag of concrete gets mixed. Soil borings, proper compaction, foundation design match to what's actually underground. These aren't luxuries for big commercial projects, they're non-negotiable even for a single-family house. The $2,000 you spend on a geotechnical report before you pour is the cheapest structural insurance you'll ever buy.
Because the alternative is the Houston math. $18,000 for the original foundation, $85,000 to fix it 5 years later. And that's not an outlier. That's what differential settlement on expansive clay routinely costs. The 5-to-1 ratio isn't a worst case, it's typical.
Here's the thing about expansive clay. It's not some exotic soil that only exists in a few places. Large portions of Texas, the Great Plains, parts of the Mountain West, significant regions of Australia and India. If you're building on expansive clay and you don't account for it, you're building a future foundation repair job. The soil expands when wet, shrinks when dry, and your foundation goes along for the ride.
Which brings us to the third actionable thing, and it's the one that applies even if you already own the building and can't go back in time to do the soil borings. It is the single most important maintenance factor for existing foundations, and it's almost boringly simple.
Gutters that actually work. Downspouts that extend at least 5 feet from the foundation, not dumping water right at the base of the wall. Soil graded to slope away from the building, not toward it. These are not expensive interventions. But they prevent the wet-dry cycling in the soil that makes expansive clay heave and shrink, which is what drives differential settlement in the first place.
People will spend $85,000 on helical piers, but won't spend $200 extending their downspouts. The expensive fix treats the symptom, the cheap fix treats the cause, but only if you do it early enough.
That's the meta lesson underneath all of this. Concrete structures are not static objects. They're in constant dialogue with their environment. The soil beneath them, the water around them, the temperature swings, the loads they carry. The cracks and deformations are the vocabulary of that dialogue. Learning to read them isn't just an academic exercise. It's how you know when the conversation has turned dangerous.
Every crack tells a story. The question is whether you're listening before the story becomes a tragedy. Here's the question that sticks with me after all this. We now have sensor networks that can monitor bridge vibrations in real time. Computer vision systems that can spot and measure cracks from drone footage. Machine learning models trained to classify crack patterns and predict propagation. Right now that stuff is for critical infrastructure. Dams, long-span bridges, high-rise cores. But the cost curve on all of it is dropping. Are we heading toward a world where your house gets a structural health report, the same way your car gets a diagnostic scan?
The technology's already closer than most people realize. There are research groups placing low-cost accelerometers in residential buildings and using ambient vibration data to detect stiffness changes that indicate developing damage. And the computer vision side is even further along. You can literally walk through a building with a phone, capture images, and an algorithm will identify, measure, and classify every crack it sees. The question isn't whether it's possible, it's whether the economics ever make sense for ordinary buildings.
Because the Houston House didn't need a neural network to tell it the foundation was sinking. It needed someone to notice the doors were sticking 5 years earlier and connect that to drainage.
That's the tension. The diagnostic tools are getting cheaper, but the bottleneck isn't detection. It's attention. People ignore the early signals because the signals are boring. A sticking door isn't a catastrophe, it's an annoyance. You shave the door, you don't call a geotechnical engineer. The question is whether automated monitoring can bypass human inattention. Whether a system that sends you a notification saying Northwest Corner has settled 4 millimeters in 6 months, check drainage, actually changes behavior before the repair bill hits $85,000.
I suspect the answer is yes for commercial property managers who have maintenance budgets and liability concerns, and no for homeowners until the sensor package costs less than a home security system, and the alert reads like a push notification, not an engineering report.
The other frontier that could change the whole prevention versus remediation calculus is self-healing concrete. This isn't science fiction. There are multiple research groups, particularly at Delft University in the Netherlands, that have embedded bacterial spores in concrete. The bacteria lie dormant for years, and when a crack forms and water enters, they activate and precipitate calcium carbonate, basically limestone, that seals the crack. Lab results show 80 to 90% crack healing in controlled conditions.
The concrete literally knits its own wounds. That changes the whole metaphor. We've been talking about concrete as a patient that needs a doctor to read its symptoms. This makes it a patient with an immune system.
The mechanism is elegant. The bacteria, typically a strain of bacillus, are encapsulated with a nutrient source, usually calcium lactate. When the crack exposes them to moisture, they metabolize the lactate and produce calcium carbonate as a byproduct. The mineral fills the crack, the bacteria go dormant again. It's a self-limiting repair cycle that doesn't require any external intervention.
The catch being that field deployment is still years away, and the cost is currently prohibitive for anything but niche applications.
5 to 10 years for meaningful commercial adoption, probably starting with structures where crack repair access is especially difficult, underground parking, marine structures, tunnel linings. The bacterial spores add to the concrete cost, and the healing only works for cracks up to about 0.8 millimeters. Bigger than that, and you still need traditional repair. But for the hairline cracks that are the early warning system for bigger problems, it's genuinely transformative.
The future looks something like this. Concrete that heals its own small wounds, sensor networks that catch the wounds that are too big to self-heal, and hopefully a generation of builders and homeowners who understand that spending $2,000 on drainage beats spending $85,000 on helical piers. The technology changes the tools, but the physics doesn't change. Concrete will always be terrible in tension, the ground will always move, and water will always find the path of least resistance.
Every crack tells a story. The question is whether you're listening before the story becomes a tragedy.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1934, a French colonial administrator in Chad attempted to preserve an entire elephant carcass by submerging it in Lake Chad's natron-rich waters, the same alkaline salts ancient Egyptians used for mummification, hoping to ship it to the Paris Natural History Museum. The carcass dissolved into a gelatinous mass within 3 weeks because the lake's salinity was only 1/10 the concentration needed for preservation, and the local villagers had apparently been too polite to mention this to him.
That's one way to learn about salt concentrations.
The politeness of local villagers is an underappreciated variable in colonial natural history. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you've got a crack in your wall that's been the same hairline since the Clinton administration, leave it alone. If it's growing, call someone. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.